Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Are you a new small group leader looking for a strong curriculum? Even if you've been a leader for years, there's always a need for tools to help you as you help others deepen their love for God and their Bible knowledge. AFA Stream is a great resource. With topics covering biblical worldview training, godly marriage, and more, you'll have access to some of the best teaching available. And if you're a Great Commission partner, you open up even more. Visit stream.afa.net today. Stream.afa.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is September 29th, and it seems like we can't wake up to a day that goes by without hearing about more political violence. And yesterday was a Sunday morning that was beautiful, and then we heard the news that now, at least reportedly, at least four people were killed and eight others wounded in a shooting of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc Township, Michigan. And authorities are saying, and this is according to CNN, a gunman rammed a vehicle through the front of the church during a large service, began shooting, and then intentionally set a fire that grew into a large blaze. And police are still believing that they may find victims in the burnt out building. The videos show the blaze that was a total loss of the church. The investigators identified the man as a 40-year-old from the nearby city of Burton. And this is just horrific. And it just seems like there is no stop to all of the negative headlines that are specifically targeting Christians and churches. And it's been 3 weeks about since Charlie Kirk was assassinated. There has been a huge revival across the country, and more people are going to church in recent weeks since that than really ever before. And the statistics are showing that there's about a 15% increase nationwide in church attendance. More Bibles are being sold. And so is it any wonder that the left is panicking about that and is concerned that people are going to church? So what's really going on here? Well, let's welcome in Gino Geraci, who is the former senior pastor of Calvary Chapel, South Denver, very dear friend of mine, my hometown pastor in my former home state of Colorado, and also an FBI chaplain. And so he was a first responder to the Columbine shooting and tragedy, so no stranger to these types of incidents. Good morning, Gino, and what do you make of all of this?
Well, good morning, Jenna. And I think that, in the large picture of what you just talked about with Charlie Kirk and with this latest eruption, if you will, it is, again, a kind of a civilizational moment. Charlie Kirk's murder was a mirror for many, many individuals. And then all across the country, people began to ask and answer the question, how do I feel about what happened to Charlie? How do I feel about it personally? And for many, many people, they're going back to what I think is stability. They need normalcy. And so, again, to your point about the most recent manifestation, if you will, obviously, everybody wants to know what motivated this particular person to do that particular thing. And again, when we ask that question about the ideological divide and then the increase in people going to church, for many, many people, despair doesn't work. Despair and hopelessness doesn't work. And so they're looking for something that will anchor them personally and then socially and civilizationally. And so I see, no pun intended, a turning point. And I know you, if memory serves me correctly, Jenna, didn't you do a couple of interviews with Charlie Kirk?
Yeah, I knew him well. I did not only a couple of interviews, but also worked on a few projects with him.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the things that shocked me was the amount of hatred and vitriol that emerged out of the Charlie Kirk shooting. I knew that Charlie was very, very influential, but Jenna, I had no idea the kind of deep hatred that was experienced in certain sections towards Charlie. And so what I'm wondering about is, in this latest incident, what possibly might have motivated this particular person? And again, as things begin to happen, people give themselves permission to do the unthinkable. So I'm thinking about a lot of things. I'm thinking about both the short-term effects, the immediate effects of loss, the mental and emotional trauma, the fear and the distress, but also the long-term effects. Can you believe it's been 26 years since Columbine? And I happen to have been with one of the parents whose child was killed at Columbine the day that Charlie Kirk was murdered. And I couldn't help but think of this arc, that the event takes place, but then it leaves a lasting wound, Jenna, that never, ever goes away.
And I think everyone who is listening to this and who's seeing the news, Gino, is feeling that and is thinking, okay, it's been, you know, 26 years since Columbine, and now, you know, we're here in this moment, and instead of feeling like we have built a more perfect union and we're continuing to advance as a society, it's like we're seeing more and more of these types of headlines, and in recent weeks, way more than I can remember, clustered so closely together. What does this say to you from a pastoral and a Christian perspective about how our society has come so far away and removed away from the things of God, the things of truth, and this just insidious lie that every human being doesn't have inherent value and worth simply for being human and made in the image of God, but that we can look at people that we disagree with and think that somehow events like this are appropriate responses. I mean, what is the commentary on the culture?
Yeah, it's interesting that obviously to me, the commentary on the culture is the weakening of the culture and the disillusion of the culture. And let me tell you what I mean by that, because just think about what's happening this very, very morning. You know, we think about the arc of Columbine and today when people are waking up. What happened at Columbine was people all across America wondered, is it safe for my children to go to school? With the synagogue shootings and other church shootings, imagine people waking up going, is it safe for me to go to church? Is it safe for me to go to church? This creates not just fear and distrust, but distrust among groups. And again, can you imagine if your ideological goal is to weaken community resolve, then this is what's happening, that the goal is to weaken community resolve. But imagine with Charlie Kirk and with the people who knew him, loved him, and cared about him, this didn't weaken community trust, it strengthened them. To your point earlier, 15% more people going to church. Even in the midst of this horror, there are people who are going, I wonder if what Charlie said about the Bible is true. I wonder if people really are made in the image of God. I wonder if the social and societal problems are linked to the reality that we're in rebellion against God, and the solution is going to once again come by trusting him, believing him. I'm wondering if we really are on sort of the precipice of a revival, and I'm hoping that's the case. So you have this push and pull that's happening right at this very moment. There is the immediate loss of life and the psychological trauma. There's the fear and the distrust that's building. There's the social response to the strain. But underneath it all, there are people who are asking the question, I wonder if whether or not a return to civility and normality and stability is our best option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like we need some stability in our society right now. I'm speaking with Gina Geraci, who's the former pastor of Calvary Chapel South Denver, hosts a radio show on Salem, as also an FBI chaplain, and very importantly as well, my dear friend, and has been a pastor to me for many years. And Gina, I think you're absolutely right that Christians need to meet this moment with faith, with truth, with answers, and with that kind of stability. And how do we do that, recognizing the dangers and preparing our churches? I would think that having more security and more members that that carry is a good idea, frankly. But to not meet this moment with fear, but with responding in the best way to advance the truth of the gospel of Christ.
Yeah. Again, think of the push and the pull that's happening, the normalization of violence. And we go, no, it's not normal. It's not normal to go into a church and shoot it up. It's not normal to go into a synagogue. That's not normal. It's not normal to expect our children to protect themselves in the school setting. And to your point, the most effective way to deal with bad people with guns is good people with guns. I know it sounds crazy and simple, but I suspect that that still remains true. I think from a cultural standpoint, imagine the long-term effects: security drills, armed guards, fortified religious spaces. Most people, they grew up in a world where that wasn't the case. I shouldn't say that. I keep forgetting that Columbine was 26 years ago. I'm wondering if security drills, armed guards, and fortified religious spaces is the new norm. And so what I guess I'm saying is the ideological shift, I think Charlie Kirk sensed this. I think what happened to Charlie happened to you, Jenna, that the point isn't a political shift towards conservatism. It's a spiritual shift towards trust in the living God of the Bible. And I saw that happening. Don't you think so? That Charlie was more and more focused, not so much on converting people to conservatism, but pointing people to Jesus and recognizing that our cultural problem is a spiritual problem.
Absolutely. And I saw that more and more throughout his ministry, really. And more and more, I've seen it now, as you said, Gino, in all of the reels and all of the things that have come out after his death, how much he focused on turning toward Christ. Because if we just have a godless populism, if we just say, well, you know, capitalism is the best system, but it's not grounded first and foremost in how we have to turn our lives over to God and then build out our policy based on an objective moral truth that's rooted in the redemptive work of the gospel of Christ, then ultimately it's just a good idea and it's maybe some policy, but it doesn't address the heart of what is broken in the world and the worldview of government overall and individual rights and all of these things that we talk about. It has to all be grounded in truth. I think Charlie understood that, and I think that's what we're seeing, and the left is also consistently now pushing back against that because the gospel message is strong right now. So I appreciate Gino so much. You can follow Gino Geraci on X. What he said is that we have to meet this moment with truth, not fear. It's all about the gospel. We'll be right back with more. I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She is 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little baby boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now, multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. How many mothers preborn has come alongside with practical and spiritual resources to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. Their goal is to save 70,000 babies by the end of the year. And they can't do that without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound, the moment everything changes. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we are seeing our society just go completely off the rails in so many different directions and contemplating exactly what happened, especially over the last perhaps 20 years, or we could go back even further than that in terms of legal precedent and how we've been told for a while now that we should simply tolerate and justify evil under the name of, you know, so-called civil rights. Well, some of our Supreme Court justices are reconsidering that and some perhaps bad precedent. And Clarence Thomas, who I think is the total GOAT, meaning the greatest of all time, if you're not familiar with that acronym, who is fantastic on the court right now, is saying that precedent might not determine cases on the upcoming Supreme Court docket that will start next month. And the court is expected to weigh in this next session on same-sex marriage, which it legalized in 2015. And so a settled legal precedent in the U.S. is not quote-unquote gospel, and in some instances may have been, quote, something somebody dreamt up and others went along with, Justice Clarence Thomas said in comments at a Catholic University of America's Columbus School of Law in Washington, D.C. on Thursday. And so ABC News and other outlets are reporting this and kind of freaking out about it, that suddenly somehow some of these cases that they have held up as, in the words of the late Dan Feinstein, Senator Feinstein, who said Roe versus Wade was super precedent. And then, of course, we saw that no, it was wrongly decided at its inception when Dobbs later overturned that decision and returned the subject matter of abortion to the people and our elected representatives, and rightly so. Well, now with the court's conservative majority, perhaps they are recontemplating what the minority in Obergefell rightly said, which is that the issue of marriage belongs to the states, and it is not for the Supreme Court to make a blanket determination and force its own will on the states, but that there were around 32 states that when Obergefell was decided in 2015 actually had constitutional amendments in their state constitutions recognizing marriage between one man and one woman. And that was wrongfully overturned. And regardless of what anyone's opinion is on same-sex marriage in terms of what the precedent should be, I absolutely 100% agree with what Justice Roberts said in his minority opinion in Obergefell, saying, you know, regardless of what you think of same-sex marriage, this is outside basically the jurisdiction of what the court should be doing here. And I think that Obergefell should be overturned, and we're seeing that that may happen. So let's welcome in Mike Donnelly, who is a constitutional law professor, who's taught constitutional law in a number of places, and is an attorney as well, and advocate for the U.S. Constitution. And so, Mike, I think this is the left is panicking at these remarks. Certainly those outlets that are reporting this from Justice Clarence Thomas. But we're seeing that in this day now, I really commend Justice Thomas for not shying away from this issue and saying, well, you know, they got it wrong in 2015 and, you know, this is going to be messy. So, we're kind of just stuck with this forever. I don't think we are. Do you think we have a real opportunity here in the next session potentially to overturn Obergefell?
Well, good morning, Jen. Always great to be with you. And I appreciate your introduction there. I like that's a new one. The advocate for the U.S. Constitution. I like that one. I think I'm going to put that somewhere, maybe on Facebook or maybe my Twitter handle. because I agree. That's exactly right. This is about the U.S. Constitution. And good morning to everyone listening. Great to be with you this morning. The question is whether they're going to take Davis v. Ermold, which is the Kim Davis case. And this goes up to the court. Matt Staver, Liberty Counsel, is representing Kim Davis. And, the question is related to the amount of money that she's being forced to pay in attorney's fees to the other side where she, lost in Kentucky. That's kind of the posture of the case. And so actually the case is before the justices today. It's scheduled for conference today. I'm kind of not sure they're going to make a decision today. They've asked for the other side to respond. The responses from the other side are due in a couple of weeks, so they may kick it until they have a chance to read those. But it's that's the question if they take the case. If they take the case, I think we talked about a few weeks ago, I can't imagine they would be taking it for any other reason than to overturn it. Because you've got, what have you got between 2015 and 2025. We've got three new justices appointed by President Donald J. Trump in his first administration, Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, and Brett Kavanaugh, all of whom are pretty solid votes, I think, going against Obergefell, written by Justice Kennedy. And at that time, kind of the culmination, honestly, when you think about, you said 20 years, I would go back 60 to 75 years. Looking at the court's activism, particularly in the social area, when you get into the 60s and then into the 70s, even the 80s and 90s with abortion and the homosexual issues and other issues as well. And so you've had a real significant change in the court's composition. And where did Obergefell come from? You know, Justice Kennedy said, well, people have animus. He used the word animus. He said, people don't like homosexuals, and therefore they're against homosexual marriage. And we can't have that in our country. And so we, the Supreme Court, are going to make the decision. And really, he meant I, Justice Kennedy, with my four liberal justices here, we're going to make the decision for everybody. But other justices have said, no, that's not the role of the court. Justice Thomas, and I think I would agree with you, he's definitely a goat, if not the goat. I'm very partial to Justice Alito also, who wrote the Dobbs decision, which I thought was extremely well written and lays the groundwork actually for overturning some of these bad cases. But Justice Thomas in Dobbs wrote that, you know what, the problem with the court inventing rights and then imposing on the rest of us is that that's not what the founders intended. That fundamentally perverts the role of courts in the U.S. Constitution. He said, because number one, it exalts judges. Number two, it distorts other parts of the Constitution. And number three, it results in disastrous outcomes. And I think he's right about that. And so I think, you know, you've seen Justice Gorsuch call substantive due process, which is where same-sex marriage rights and homosexual rights kind of came from, this notion that the court can invent rights that are not in the Constitution. He called that a legal fiction in 2019. Justice Alito described substantive due process as a treacherous field. Justice Thomas has said, we just need to revisit this, and it's just not legit what we're doing. Amy Coney Barrett has criticized aggressive due process enforcement as risking over-nationalizing policy. Kavanaugh hasn't really said a whole lot about it, but I'm sure he's sympathetic. And then it comes down to, okay, what is Justice Roberts going to do? You pointed out what he said in Obergefell. So if he's true to his convictions from Obergefell, I think you're going to see Obergefell overturned if they take this Kim Davis case.
And that's really an incredible win, I think, if that happens for the Constitution, not just for conservative side and our views, but really our entire system, because this is all about the rule of law and our constitutional republic versus judicial will and activism, as Roberts pointed out in his dissent. And as we've talked about on this program before, Mike Donnelly, I would not see Justice Roberts changing or modifying his strongly worded dissent in Obergefell, especially now when it seems that the majority of the court is conservative. And so practically speaking, when they're in conference, the justices are in conference and they decide to take a case, it takes only four in order to accept that on their docket, but there are, you know, nine justices. And so what are the practical kind of chess moves that they're thinking? Because if four aren't convinced that they'll get to five in terms of a majority opinion, then they likely wouldn't take it up. And so what are kind of some of the behind the scenes practical realities of how all of this works?
Well, I wish I could tell you how the court works. It's very cloaked, you know, and even, you know, I know Supreme Court clerks and they are tight-lipped. They just don't talk about, you know, what happens much, at least not to me anyway. I mean, so the court, you know, there's the court justices are talking to each other. They're thinking. You saw Justice Thomas speaking at the Catholic University. You know, they're going to come into conference. And if, you know, if there's four votes for it, you know, you've got Alito, Roberts, and Thomas, who wrote a blistering and joined blistering dissents in 2015. And you just need one of the other ones of the new three. You got Gorsuch, you know, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Will they go along with it? I don't know. It's hard to know. Has the court overturned such recent precedent? I mean, there are a couple of cases where the court has overturned precedent within 10 years. In fact, when you go back and look at the homosexual issue, you have Lawrence v. Texas overturning Bowers v. Hardwick just 10 years later, and that was Kennedy. So, you know, when you change judges, sometimes you can get quick turnarounds. And this issue, the sexual issues have been, you know, very rife with changes in the court. And that's why I say you go back to the 60s when a lot of that stuff started. And I think that I hope that the new majority on the court will say, you know what, this is just not the role of the Supreme Court. You know, people, you said in your opening, the Supreme Court, quote unquote, legalized homosexual marriage, same-sex marriage. That's not the court doesn't legalize things. Mm-hmm. To legalize something, you have to have a law. Laws are passed by legislatures or elected by the people. And fundamentally, what we're talking about here is self-governance. Are we the people going to decide for ourselves how we are going to be governed and the laws that we're going to live by? Or are individual judges going to do that? That's the fundamental question here. And I do believe that there is a majority in the court who wants to go in that direction. You saw that in Dobbs. Justice Alito wrote a great opinion. He said, look, this is not the role of the federal judiciary. States, you decide what to do. And clearly, this is another situation where that needs to happen. And if states want to do things differently, like they were in the, you know, up to 2015, you had 12 states that had different things like civil unions, or they had their own legalized same-sex marriage. And you run into issues with full faith and credit and things like that. But we can navigate those waters if we need to. But at the end of the day, it's a question of, are we going to live by our own rules or somebody else's rules?
Well, and so let me ask you this too, especially in the context of where we find ourselves at this moment with what is very clearly a rise of trans violence, of you know, the left saying that they don't even want to address issues in public debate in the public square. They're attacking Christians. Obviously, the assassination of Charlie Kirk. I mean, all of this. If the Supreme Court takes up this case, and that is the likely posture that they are going to overturn Obergefell, this is just striking at the heart of what the left is wanting in terms of the policy outcomes on so many levels. I mean, I was just reading a headline the other day that said that three men in a polyamorous relationship were now for the first time adopting a young girl. I mean, just truly disgusting stuff that is an outcome of Obergefell, frankly, and all of these issues of parentage and all of these issues that have come from that. If the Supreme Court is poised to strike at the heart of what the left has won over the last decade, how do you see that playing out in terms of where of the left's response to this? And do you think that the Supreme Court will have the spine to deal with it?
I do think they have the spine to deal with it. I think you're seeing the response of the left in the last week. You had a church burning in Michigan. You had another shooting. The left is violent. And they're going to be violent. And so we are forewarned about that. And we are going to go through a period of time. I think we've got very brave justices on the Supreme Court who realize that the Republic is at stake here, and they have an opportunity to put it on a new course, a different course, and change course. This term has got a number of those issues. You've got several transgender-related issues. I even hate to use that term because I just think, you know, it's about the language. The left wants to use the language. You know, we have confused people who, you know, want to use other sexes' bathrooms and play in other sexes' sports, which is crazy. Sorry. But you've got Little v. Hecox. You've got WVBPJ, a couple cases that the court is going to hear this term on the sports issue. You've got Chiles v. Salazar out of Colorado, which is a counseling case on the issue of can counselors help people who are confused process through the issues that they're confused about, which is causing them to question that they were born the wrong sex. So the court is dealing with this issue, and clearly they think they need to because they want to, and they definitely need to. So I think they're brave enough. I think that they understand the stakes, and I'm hopeful that they'll give us an opportunity to reassert self-governance. And, you know, but we're gonna face some difficulties, some challenges in the next few years related to this. And thank God that we have a president who is leading by example and saying, you know what, we're not going to put up with crime. We're not going to put up with this kind of lawlessness and violence, and we're going to crack down on it, and we're going to put people in jail, which is what needs to happen when people commit crimes.
Yeah, well said. And I hope, and we have to take a break here, Mike Donnelly, we could talk about this a lot more, and I'm sure we'll have you on we learn in the next few days or weeks the court's posture on this case. But I am hopeful that the court does have a spine with this, and that they won't be put off by all of the not only left-wing violence, but the cultural commentary, the policy, the political vitriol, all of that, but will focus like they did in the Dobbs case, simply on the Constitution and simply saying that this is an issue that needs to be returned to the people, their elected representatives, and it's nowhere for them to decide. In the words of Justice Roberts, he said, just who do we think we are? Well, it's not for the Supreme Court to overstep their boundaries by transforming the institution of marriage. So let's pray for this, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, in some really surprising news, actually, Eric Adams dropped out of the New York City mayoral race as Mamdani gains ground. That's the headline from Fox News. Adams also trailed both Mamdani and Cuomo significantly in campaign fundraising and spending. And so he dropped out of the city's mayoral race yesterday on Sunday, halting his reelection campaign just 5 weeks before Election Day. Adams announced his decision in a nearly 9-minute video posted on social media, offering no clues about his plans leaving office. And so this appears to be, in what a lot of commentators are suggesting, because of his placement behind Andrew Cuomo, that this is really to coalesce a support for Cuomo rather than to the Democrat socialist Mamdani. And it's really, frankly, sad that we're here in a position where Cuomo is probably the best option given the alternative. But let's welcome in John Cardillo, who is a GOP strategist, former NYPD. And John, a couple of headlines to get to with you this morning. But first, your thoughts on the New York City mayoral race.
You know, good morning, Jenna. Not surprising at all. You know, in New York City, as the Democratic primary goes, the general election goes. I mean, you've got something like, I checked it about a month and a half ago, I think 3.3 million more Democrat voters in New York than Republican. Voter turnout is historically low in New York, right? I think the last five cycles, it barely broke 35%, and overwhelmingly for the Democrat. And so Mamdani has the Democrat machine. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think this is a move by Adams to coalesce behind Cuomo in a last-ditch effort to stop, you know, a communist, a radical Muslim communist from becoming mayor in New York City. But I think it's futile. You know, they've got the Democratic machine. Mamdani has the teachers' unions going out there harvesting ballots, driving people to the polls. That's just what they do. So it's a massive up structure in New York City.
Yeah, and at last reports that I heard, Curtis Sliwa is who's the Republican is sitting at about 11%, and this is unfortunately, I think the reality is that, as you mentioned, just given the demographics, how many more registered Democrats, all of that, the primary goes ultimately, then, you know, the general likely will go to the Democrat. Is this something where he should take a different look or say, you know, hey, I'm representing the Republicans. If they want to vote for me, great. Or is this a situation that the Republicans are potentially looking at saying, you know, hey, we want to stop the radical, you know, Muslim socialist. And so as much as, you know, we hate to say it, Cuomo is better than that alternative. And because some people are actually calling for him to for Sliwa to drop out of the race as well.
Which I thought was a smart move, because Curtis tried to run last time. He lost by 50 or 60 points. You know, he's been a fixture in New York City. We started the Guardian Angels back in the 1970s, but nobody really has taken him seriously as a mayor, right? He had the Guardian Angels. He had a successful radio show. But he's tried the mayoral thing. It's never worked. It's not going to work again. So I thought he should have dropped out as well. You know, you could say a million bad things about Cuomo. The one thing you can't say negative about Cuomo is that he was soft on crime. Because if you remember when Bill de Blasio basically had the NYPD stand down during the Black Lives Matter and Antifa riots, Cuomo ordered in New York State troopers. He put 100 state troopers around Wall Street, and basically crime plummeted in that area. The muggings and all stopped. So if it was on crime alone, I think they'd rather have Cuomo than Mamdani. Absolutely.
Well, and so where do you put the possibility that the Republicans and especially the party will encourage him to drop out and tell voters to put their weight behind Cuomo just for this purpose? I mean, unfortunately, I can see as well where that would be the smart move because, you know, 11% isn't going to get you a win in the general, but it may get you a loss.
He's kind of stubborn. Yeah, so Sleeve was kind of stubborn. So I've been told by people pretty close to it all that he has, they've implored him to drop out for exactly that reason. Like, look, you've got 11%. It's mathematically impossible for you to win. So drop out, get behind Cuomo. Let's do a bipartisan coalition behind him, at least stem the bleed in the city. And apparently Sleeve refuses to drop out. So I thought it was pretty selfish of him, and I do trust the sources who told me that he's refusing, even though he knows he can't win. So, I thought it was pretty selfish considering what's going to come to the city.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think when, you know, you look at all of the factors involved, if you can't see a clear path and there really isn't one, then sometimes, you know, the greater good requires that. So it'll be interesting to see how all of that plays out. But let's turn to this other headline that I would like your commentary on, John Cardillo, and you can follow him, of course, on X. I'd encourage you to do that, especially for Florida local politics as well. John tends to weigh in with some really great takes on all the things going on in our home state here. But this headline relates to Oregon, and this is coming from Politico. Oregon sues to block Trump from deploying the state's National Guard in Portland. The governor said that local law enforcement has this under control. I kind of laughed out loud at that. But Oregon and its largest city, Portland, are suing to block President Donald Trump from deploying the state's National Guard, calling it an unconstitutional abuse of power. Your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's ridiculous. It's exactly under the purview of the President of the United States. And this is just as laughable as Brennan Johnson and J.B. Pritzker in Chicago when over the last holiday weekend they were saying, we don't need the National Guard. This is the safest city in America. And the headline next to them was 55 shot, 7 dead over that weekend. And so I think these leftists, these blue states, and these politicians are going to try. But the biggest problem they're going to have, Jenna, is that Trump's deployment strategy worked incredibly well in D.C. Crime absolutely fell off a cliff. And so, you know, sure, you can cherry pick a judge. You know this better than anybody. You're a practicing attorney. But I think I just don't see these things being upheld on appeal, even if they do get those district judges to make. He's the commander-in-chief. He can declare an emergency. He can declare a crisis, and he can deploy resources to that crisis. So I don't see what legal grounds they have anyway.
Yeah, and I thought that the statement by the Oregon Attorney General, Dan Rayfield, who, of course, is a Democrat, was utterly ridiculous. But he said this: it's actually un-American, if you think about it, to use the military against our own citizens. But that's exactly what's happening right now across our country. And he said that his office plans to file within the next day for a temporary restraining order against the deployment from the Department of War sending troops to Portland. And it's un-American to use the military against citizens when our own government in Portland is not actually enforcing law and order. I mean, this is so convoluted. And the Democrats actually think that anyone is buying this and saying, you know, yeah, we're all for these crime-ridden cities. I mean, they must be to some extent if they keep electing these Democrats that aren't enforcing the law. But to suggest that somehow using law enforcement tools to enforce the law is un-American, I mean, it's just patently laughable.
Yeah, it is. You know, and it's important for the audience to understand what the National Guard, what the military is actually doing there. So they're not the primary line of putting handcuffs on people and doing the apprehensions, right? They're a force multiplier. They're a presence. They're there armed in their kits to tell the bad guys, you're not going to do it on this corner. Well, you saturate enough corners with them, then the bad guys go underground. So they're not out there on patrol. They're not answering radio calls. They're not responding to domestic violences, you know, geared up for battle. They're simply there to back up local police or step in if the politicians tie the hands of local police. But that really is the last resort. They're just going to be there in the background providing support. So these Democrat histrionics of American troops are being turned on American citizens, it's just pathetically.
Yeah. And I think we might have lost John here for a little bit. Can we see if his connection is better? Okay, and I'm told that he's back. You there, John?
Yeah, I'm back, Jennifer. Sorry
okay.
about that. Yeah,
all right.
Something gets out on us.
No worries. You know, yeah, it's the little, you know, Democrats going in and trying to mess with our studios. No, I'm kidding. But you know, but Politico also points out that this lawsuit closely tracks a similar suit filed by California Governor Gavin Newsom in June when Trump deployed the National Guard and active duty Marines to Los Angeles against the commentary, of course, of Newsom and local officials. But he won a quick restraining order in that case. But the Ninth Circuit ultimately blocked the lower court's decision, effectively allowing the deployment. So likely this is going to track along similar lines. And hopefully not even have, you know, kind of that quick restraining order. And we'll see, you know, kind of where this goes. But why do you think from just a law enforcement perspective, John, that that Trump is targeting Portland now? I mean, and where are potentially some other places that he might send deployments if the courts of appeals are effectively going to allow these types of movements?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty clear why, right? These are the cities where Antifa were born, Portland's, the Seattle's. And so there's a lot of that activity there. He's hot on declaring Antifa a terrorist organization. So that made sense to me. And then we don't know what law enforcement intelligence analysts. The FBI's intel people, I mean, NYPD has a robust intel, right? Infrastructure they share with other agencies. But we don't know if some intel surfaced that was actionable that said, you know, X group is pretty active in Portland and they're going to branch out nationally. So.
All right. And I think we're still losing John here. So I don't know if his connection is not great. We'll try to get him back for the last few minutes. But, you know, really what he's saying is that President Trump is taking a holistic view of this. And, you know, I don't think that this is just in any way politically, you know, kind of motivated in terms of just wanting to call out the Democrats on, you know, get kind of some good talking points for the midterms, you know, sort of thing. Although that is one collateral effect. I mean, I think this is President Trump just absolutely fed up with how there is a lack of law enforcement in these cities. And, you know, this is, in my opinion, the right move. And I'm told that we have John Cardillo back. And, you know, John, when you're seeing some of these situations, even, you know, even leftists like Don Lemon, who, you know, is just laughable, but, you know, he's out, you know, conducting these man on the street sort of interviews. And when he's asking people in some of these cities, like in Chicago, you know, what do they think? And they're all saying, you know, yeah, we want somebody to come in and actually take care of crime on the streets. I mean, people aren't sitting here and saying that they're scared of the military, all of these, you know, kind of like what Wolf Blitzer is posting about D.C. and like, oh, no, look at, you know, there's somebody in camo. I'm scared. It's like people actually want to see that there is law enforcement to not just feel safe, but actually be safe on their own streets.
100%. And I never understood this trend of Democrat politicians acting as if their constituents hate law enforcement because they don't, right? I mean, look, when I was a rookie cop, I worked in a 99% non-white command. It was primarily Black and Dominican. Only 4 to 6% of that neighborhood had a criminal element, and it was one of the highest crime areas in New York City. But the 94% of people who were just really working lower income wanted the police there. They welcomed it. They were happy when we were there. They were coming to the precinct, sitting at the community councils, begging for more cops on the street. But the Democrats in power will tell you that's not the case. So the only logical conclusion is that the Democratic Party really does cater to that 4 to 6% fringe criminal element. There's no other explanation for it, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I don't think that is going to bode well for them, not only in terms of the legal outcome of some of these cases. I mean, we've seen what's happened in D.C. and California, and I think it'll go that way for Portland. But also, you know, with the midterms, I mean, I think that people are fed up with this, and hopefully even Democrat base voters will see this and recognize that this isn't about, you know, all of the things that they've been lied to about the policies on the left. This is ultimately about what kind of country, what kind of city, what kind of community do they really want to live in? And law and order is a good thing. So John Cardillo, really appreciate your commentary this morning. And again, you can follow him on X. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Pray for this country.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.